data constraints, cosmological constraints, and implications of these constraints for phenomenology. So main motivation for me to study this is the evidence for dark matter that we have in the cosmos. So I won't go through this, you're all pretty aware of this evidence that we have on the widespread of scales in the cosmos. And well, the best number from all these evidences comes from the analysis of the anisotropies, temperature anisotropies, and also the microwave background. From there, we know that about 22% of the total energy content in the universe should be made out of this dark matter. And that's actually, I think, one of the key questions in present-day research. What is the identity of dark matter? And well, we all know that it cannot be within the standard model. Neutrinos look, in the first place, as a good candidate. They have mass. Unfortunately, the neutrino mass is too small, so that would neutrinos alone, they wouldn't fit together with the picture that we see from structure formation. So you have to go to theories beyond the standard model, and one very popular theory is, of course, the supersymmetric extension of the standard model. And here's maybe the most popular dark matter candidate within the supersymmetric extension of the standard model. It's the Lice neutralino. Let me just quickly review the properties in order to contrast it with the Calvitino. Like neutralino is already part of the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. It's a spin 1/2 Majorana fermion. It's a mixture of the Bino, Vino, the neutralinos, has a mass of the order of the electroweak scale, and has weak interactions. The Calvitino, strictly speaking, is not part of the minimal supersymmetric standard model. Nevertheless, it's, I would say, equally well motivated. It's the gauge field associated with local supersymmetry transformations, so it really sits at the heart of supersymmetry, if you believe that supersymmetry is local symmetry. And I think that's what most of us deans do. It's the superpartner of the graviton. It's a spin 3/2 particle. And it's the superpartner of the graviton. It has also interactions that are suppressed by the Planck scale. So it's an extremely weakly interacting particle. So it's a dimensional coupling. You have, therefore, a momentum here in the numerator. What about the Calvitino mass? Well, the Calvitino mass directly reflects the Susy braking mechanism, depends here on this F of the F term, E term. And there we have a wide menu of Susy braking scenarios available. And depending on what you choose, you get either a mass here in the EV range, that is, for example, engagement gauge supersymmetry braking, and it can go up even up to 100 TeV, like a normally mediated supersymmetry braking, or mirage mediated supersymmetry braking. Talking about dark matter, there we are interested in the case where the Calvitino is the lightest supersymmetric particle that cannot decay because of R parity conservation. And throughout this talk, I assume that R parity is a conserved quantum number. So I consider mainly these cases here where you have a Calvitino mass that is of the order of the electroweak scale or lighter. Yeah, here is the supergravity Lagrange. It's written in a compact form. You know this maybe from Asperger. And so there are, for example, Calvitino interactions in there. This is the Calvitino field. And here is this is this term where the Calvitino couples with engaging or engaged bosons. And there you see the suppression by the Planck scale. And it's really, I mean, you don't have freedom here. It's really not model dependent. That's really supergravity. So you can't play around much with the Calvitino interactions. You might wonder, if it's such an extremely weakly interacting particle, how do you produce this in the first place in the universe? And in fact, typically the Calvitino is not like the neutralino in thermal equilibrium because of the weak couplings. Nevertheless, there is this momentum here. And if you have a very hot early universe, let's say with a temperature of 10 to the 7 GeV, and then in processes like this one here, where you have two gluinos scattering into a Calvitino and a gluino, then you really here at these temperatures, you get these temperatures up here in the numerator, and that compensates for part of the suppression here. And that means for such high temperatures in the very hot early universe, this thermal production can become an efficient mechanism. And, okay. I was talking about higher heating temperatures, and here is a very simple picture here of reheating. You have an inflaton field that dominates universe, it decays, and this decay entropy is generated, and the inflaton field decays into radiation, and from there, from this decay, you get some reheating temperature 10 to the 9, and starting from this point on, you have this radiation dominated epoch in the universe, and here that's how we define we are this relation. This is the cadence of the inflaton field, and that is people use different numbers here, so I use psi here. So from that, you define the reheating temperature here, and in this plot, you have a reheating temperature, for example, of 10 to the 9 GeV. And the Gambettino production, I mean, this is what you get if you calculate all these processes that you have in the early universe. It's another Boltzmann equation. It's only Gambettino generation here, taking into account the annihilation, you can forget because it's too dilute. Anyhow, and so this turns out to be very sensitive exactly to this reheating temperature. I should really say it's a bit of a simple-minded picture. There is a Fumi Takahashi, who is an expert on how you can also, from the case of such an inflaton field, directly get Gambettinos. That is something which I do not consider here. So in a way, it is, yeah, let's maybe say conservative, simplifies the picture a lot. And yeah, but these inflaton things are very important. Okay, so carrying out this program and computing the Rayleigh density, that's what you want to contrast with the observed dark matter density, we find actually that although the Gambettinos are weakly interacting, you can have a match between the Gambettino Rayleigh abundance only from thermal production with the observed dark matter density. It depends, as I said, on this reheating temperature here, and it depends also on the Gambettino mass. Why is that? That is because the Gambettino has also these Goldsteiner components. And the lighter the Gambettino is, the more important become the Goldsteiner components, the more strongly does the Gambettino couple. So a light Gambettino has stronger interactions than a heavy Gambettino. You can turn around this plot and now show here this region where you have the agreement with the dark matter abundance as a function of the Gambettino mass. And here's now the reheating temperature, and that tells you, for example, that for a given Gambettino mass, let's say 10 GeV, you cannot have a higher reheating temperature, for example, as 10 to the 8, because then you would have too much Gambettino dark matter. So in this way, this thermal Gambettino production gives you an upper bound on the reheating temperature after inflation. Why is this important? Of course, it's important for model building of inflation. You predict some reheating temperature that you can directly contrast with these limits. Moreover, there are baryogenesis models, such as thermal leptogenesis, which typically require very high reheating temperatures, such as 10 to the 9 GeV. And you see thermal leptogenesis, this Gambettino dark matter, would only be viable here in this corner up here. Yeah. Please note that this, because of the Goldsteiner components, that the amount of Gambettinos that you get is very sensitive also here to your Gaugino mass parameter. And thereby you can turn once more this plot around, plot it in a different way. Here's again the Gambettino mass. Here's the Gaugino mass parameter, and now for fixed temperatures, you get these contours, and in principle, that is something that you probe at a collider, this M1/2 value, and from there, you could see that which reheating temperatures might become possible. So what I showed here are the reheating temperatures that you would need for thermal leptogenesis. Let's assume you would measure, or you would infer from the measurements at the collider, this Gaugino mass parameter, then that would tell you that thermal leptogenesis would only be viable here for higher Gambettino masses. If you are below, if you are here, small Gambettino masses, you are above this line, too much Gambettino dark matter. So yeah, that gives you more constraints. Second mechanism, how to generate Gambettinos in the cosmos is from the case of your lightest standard model superpartner. That is now the next to lightest supersymmetric particle. And that doesn't feel much of the presence of the Gambettino. So for that one, you have still the standard WIMP freeze-out mechanism. Now this lightest standard model superpartner can even have charges. It must not be the lightest neutralino. It can be an electrically charged particle, like the lightest tau. And that's the one that's maybe most interesting for purposes of collider physics. So here you are not really sensitive to the lifetime. It can happen at 1 second, for example, and then you get for each NLSP, you get one Cupertino, and here is then the parameter space. Here you show, you see the Cupertino mass, this is the Stau mass. Here I assume now that the NLSP is the lighter Stau. And then here from the NLSP decays alone, you get an agreement with the observed dark matter density in this gray band. Sometimes this is referred to as the super Wim Cupertino dark matter scenario. Yeah? And here the three dots, this is Cupertinos from inflaton production, which I am not taking into account here. Okay, so that's to convince you here that it is possible to get the right amount of Cupertino dark matter already from these two very generic production mechanisms. Okay, let's go back here to this plot from the NLSP decays of the Stau. And what is plotted also here are contours of the Stau lifetime. So here you see a lifetime of 1 second that is here. Here is 100 seconds, 10 to the 4 seconds, 10 to the 7 seconds. So it's a very long-lived particle. Let me remind you, why is it so long-lived? That is because there you are really affected by the suppression from the Planck scale in the denominator. And okay, so you have typically a very long-lived NLSP, and for collider purposes, then this NLSP, the Stau, would basically appear basically as a stable charged particle, and that would be something like a signature for such dark matter scenarios, for a Cupertino dark matter scenario. It would be very different from the large missing energy signal of neutralino dark matter. Yeah. And of course, there is a what people are already searching for, or have been searching for at the lab. There is at the moment the best bound coming from. So from that, we know that if such a Stau NLSP exists, it has to be heavier than 100 GeV. Teleton data is still analyzed, not yet competitive with the lab bound, but I heard there is still a lot of data on the tapes. And maybe we find something, we see something, or we get a better limit from the Teleton. Okay, that is something that is in theory studied since quite a while already, so just to give some references here at this point. Let's go back to the lifetimes. These lifetimes of 1 second, you might recall from cosmology, that's where you have a Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So if you are here in this region, longer lifetimes, then these decays happen during or after Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And we heard already in the plenary talk, for example, by Keith Olive, that there we have a very good picture, a very good agreement, in particular here with deuterium and helium. This year we have a problem, but okay, let's put this aside and let's consider this year. This is a good agreement. You don't want to spoil this. And with such a Stau NLSP, it could happen that you spoil it. I mean, you have a particle that decays, for example, when the universe is 10 hours old, and when this decays into the Cupertino and the Stau, this can be a very energetic jet, depending on the mass splitting between these two particles. And when this hits, for example, a helium nucleus that is produced here, then it splits it into two deuterium, and you see, I mean, helium is about 25% here of the baryonic mass that's in helium, but deuterium is only 10 to the, let's say, minus 4 here. So only a few helium nuclei, a small fraction of this helium destroyed with such processes can easily give you a strong mismatch here. So that's something you have to care about, and we had a BBN workshop here before the PAS course, and there were quite a number of experts in that field were present here. We had very lively discussions. It's the second mechanism that is only discussed since 2006. That is not related to energy release, but to the possibility of forming bound states. So a Stau is a charged particle. There are positive, negatively charged Staus, so they can form bound states with the helium nucleus. And Maxime Pospiloff was pointing out that this mechanism here, that can enhance the production of helium 6 by many orders of magnitude. So that is something very serious, and becomes in particular relevant if you have, if you are at a universe of age of an hour, for example. Now, since this paper also, there are lots of activity and this ongoing improvements. So let's look now. I mean, how do these BBN constraints look now in our parameter space? This is again the plot here where you see the gravitino mass on the x-axis, the star mass on the y-axis. Here was the region with the cleavage with the observed dark matter density. And now you see here, this is, for example, the Big Bang nuclear synthesis bound from the injection of hadronic energy during BBN. And then exclude this here. If you sit within this region, you would spoil the deuterium success of BBN. Yeah? So this is excluded. And this here, the blue line, that is from electromagnetic energy injection. And that excludes these lifetime, these parameter space here. So before 2006, we thought that all that here would be allowed. And then came this Maxime's paper with these bound state effects. And then you see that a really considerable amount of the parameter space, of the previously viable parameter space, is killed by this lithium fixed constraint. Yeah. So yeah, if you want to have this scenario realized in nature, you should be living here in this wide region. And I plotted here gravitino mass starting from 5 GeV on to higher values. Of course, if you have gauge mediated supersymmetry breaking, that was the scenario that Nathan Seibert was discussing, then you can have much smaller gravitino masses and much smaller lifetimes. So then you would not be affected by this limit. So these limits are here mainly relevant for a gravity mediated supersymmetry breaking scenario. Yeah, so that's what you want to do. You want to see this at a collider and you want to confront it with the BBN bounds. Yeah? And for example, at the collider, we would, with such signatures, I think, be able to measure the mass, for example, of this DAO. So we would measure the value here. And let's say it is, for example, 500 GeV. Then the bounds, the BBN bounds, would tell us that the gravitino mass should not be heavier than 20 GeV. So it's really a direct interplay of BBN constraints with collider physics, which you can play here. And okay, one can look at this also within the context of the constraint minimal supersymmetric standard model, and just to show some more plots. So just a reminder here, this constraint minimal supersymmetric standard model, you assume that at the gut scale, you have universal scalar masses m0 and universal gauge masses m1/2. And you've seen many times already these scans, I guess. So you have m1/2 down here and m0 here. And every point in this plane, for given time, that's beta, a0, mu parameter, side of the mu parameter, corresponds to a well-defined spectrum. So you see, you evolve this down to the electronic scale. And then you have a very well-defined spectrum. Up here, above this line, you have the neutralino, is the gravitino LSP, the neutralino is the NLSP. And down here, you have this DAO as the NLSP. If you people look at neutralino dark matter, this region below here is not considered because the neutralino dark matter lives up here. But now with gravitino dark matter, we can consider the full region. And in fact, it turns out that the BBN constraints strongly disfavor this region here with the neutralino NLSP due to hadronic BBN constraints. Yeah, this is in such a scan now here. The green band show the regions where you get the right gravitino dark matter abundance. And you see it's a picture that is very different from the neutralino picture. Neutralino, you have the correlation strip here. For gravitino dark matter, you have an agreement in completely different regions here. Yeah? And this is now a function, of course. The green bands are a function of the heating temperature in the early universe and your choice of the gravitino mass. Now, how do the BBN constraints look on this picture? Looks quite drastic. Here is this constraint from lithium. This is the constraint for hadronic energy injection. So everything to the left is excluded. So if the gravitino mass is indeed given here with such a relation, then we can only live consistently with these constraints here in this very high m1/2 region. And you see also that the heating temperature that is then possible, the highest one is about 10 to the 7 GeV, while 10 to the 9 GeV is excluded by the BBN constraints. Yeah, that's an important implication here, this constraint on the heating temperature. Direct implications now for inflation at the origin of the barrier symmetry. So, yeah, it's student Josef Bratler, we looked at this in the CMSS M, and we found that we could express this reheating temperature limit as an analytic expression that has only a mild dependence of the gravitational mass. Yeah, I was addressing this question of probing reheating temperatures at a collider. And now you can confront this picture here with the EBM constraints, and then you see that these values of the reheating temperatures that you need for thermal epigenesis, that they are really here disfavored by the BDN constraints. Okay, some analytic equations, and that's my next to last slide. So that tells us here these BDN constraints that gravitational dark matter with the GPD scale mass, as obtained, for example, in gravity mediated supersymmetry breaking, could be very difficult to probe at the LHC. How do you see this? For example, you can plot now here the contour of the Brunino mass of 2.5 TdV, and you see that the allowed region here can be at higher values of the Brunino mass. So if that would be realized, then we won't see any supersymmetry at the LHC. But please keep in mind that it's still possible to have gauge-mediated supersymmetry pre-breaking with a much smaller gravitational mass, and there these limits do disappear. Warning, I should say that these limits that I showed you so far all assumed a standard cosmological history, and we had a talk already, Scott Watson was telling us that we might have a non-standard cosmological history that is also relevant here. For example, if you have some late-time entropy production, then you can get rid of these bounds, in particular if you produce entropy after NLSP decoupling and before BBN, then you can dilute the abundance of your stars, and thereby you reduce the energy that is injected, then you reduce the effect from these bound states and so on. However, I should really say that this is, in particular to rescue thermal leptogenesis, this is really on the edge. To rescue thermal leptogenesis, you need a dilution of 10 to the 4, and with that you need, for example, a scalar field that dominates the energy density already during the decoupling of your NLSP, and thereby we have an enhanced Hubble ray and so on. So it's not so tricky, but we just managed to get it, but the higher dilution factor, I don't think we can get. And what we did not take into account here is that this field that makes the dilution could also decay into supersymmetric particles, then you would have another source for stars, which would make these limits again more severe. And could also decay into gravitinos and so on, but okay, that is a bit more model dependent and the picture beyond standard cosmology. So nevertheless, despite all the constraints, so that would be something I would be hoping for to see this in the next few years. So that would be a long-lived star NLSP, for example, in the CMS detector, which would be something like a smoking gun for gravitino, or to talk about it here, axiom dark matter at the LHC. Okay, thanks a lot.
Any questions? Well, when you say style, you mean right-handed style?
Oh, not necessarily.
It doesn't matter.
Here the computation, it makes it sometimes easier to use a right-handed style. For example, when I calculated this harmonic BBN constraints, I assumed a right-handed style that had to reduce the number of Feynman diagrams you had to compute. It's actually not such a bad approximation in this CMSSM, for example. You find that the star is typically very much right-handed. Yeah.
But your previous plot showing, let's say, cutoffs from overproduction of lithium-6, would that change significantly for those plots? Did that assume a right-handed style? Or?
I assumed a typical, or we assumed a typical. A typical abundance for the star in NSP. So there's a paper by Hamaguchi, Asaka, Suzuki. I think they considered the star annihilation processes, and they considered the right-hand one. And there is in this picture, you assume a star abundance, and you assume a star abundance that is typical from the typical one from star freeze-out. Yeah, and that goes in here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Nevertheless, I should say that the lithium bound actually is very steep for. So if you still have the chart here.
You can write here.
Okay. So you this lithium bond looks something like this. It's a function of the lifetime, and here's the abundance of the negatively charged cells. Then you have the curve that looks basically like this. And here are these lifetimes. For example, here is 10 to the 3 seconds, 10 to the 4 seconds. And here, here are the typical star yields, basically. Yeah. So, and this goes by orders of magnitude, so it's very steep that you are not so sensitive to the details here of the star couplings.
Very good. So, let's thank our speaker again.